Good to see everybody. It's good to see you. And it's good to see you guys. Thanks for coming. So my name's Tuere Salah. I want to check and see if anyone's new, either on Zoom or here. Pretty new. That's good enough to be new. I think that's actually kind of good. I'm kind of new. Every time I show up here, it feels like I haven't been here in forever. So we are going to have a talk again tonight. I know we had a talk about this this topic last week, but we're going to have another one tonight. We are talking about the Oxfordine stories. They're a Zen practice, but we're putting our own spin on it, and it seems to be going pretty good. So I'll kind of explain all that. So tonight we are going to continue on our journey into these ox herding stories. And I've given this talk two times already. This is the third time, but I want to talk about it a little differently. I've been talking about, I gave this Thursday night and then I gave it for Sunday morning. But this time I want to talk about it a little differently. I do want to start with this framing. For those of you that haven't been following the series, the ox herding stories is basically 10 stories about the progression of our practice, the unfolding of our practice and how it unfolds. But each story, which is really a picture and a verse, it is a story in and of itself. And so it's important not to think, oh, I'm only in story number two when I really should be in story number 10. We create this image in our minds that one, that 10 is better than two. Or if I'm at seven and I'm stuck at seven, I should be getting to eight. And that kind of thinking is more problematic. And it's not really the truth of what these ox herding stories are pointing to. Each one of these stories, the best way to think of it is a story in and of itself. And like any good story, they have parts that are inspiring and help you see the benefit of it. And then they also have parts that are challenges. Like a good movie, a good story has, a good drama, some kind of challenge, something that has to be worked over. And so each one of these stories contains within themselves both the inspiration and the gift of this moment in time in your practice, this stage in practice in general, and the challenges and tensions that you have to look out for. So if you hold it as the story, then you are less, comparing where you're at with where you think you should be. So that's really what this is all about. This is really about, I want to talk about the story of what happens when, we finally see the truth of our, the possibility of awakening. So in the picture, the story we're in this month, it is called catching the ox or catching the bull. And so this means that for those of you that are just starting out here now, we started with searching for it. Something that we heard, we didn't see nothing, and we start searching, and then we see some footprints that indicate that, oh, there might be something here. No, hold on. And we start really getting a deeper search, and then we see the back part of the ox last month, and then this month, we've actually caught it, seized it, and it's what's about to happen in this month. So a couple of things to set this up to get us to put a framing around the story, which is we have the bull. I mean, what the bull is, or this ox, is not something other. It is ourselves. What we are seeing is the truth of our own liberation. That's what we're seeing. For 3 months now, we've been talking about this possibility of seeing the truth of who we are. And now we see fully the truth of who we are. And in the picture, the yogi is about this big and the bull is about this big. And so the idea is here that our true self, who we really are, is way bigger than the limited way in which we perceive ourselves. We perceive ourselves in this very limited egoic sense. And yet what is possible is a liberated mind. We are Buddhas. I mean, I don't know how to, I'm gonna try not to get way out there, because last time I got way out there. So I'm gonna try to keep it contained. But the truth is, we are Buddhas. We don't know we're Buddhas. We don't believe we're Buddhas, but we are. We're already, I guess I should say it like this. Every single one of us in Zoom, here in this room, every practitioner that comes through Seattle Insight or practices through any of these sanghas in the world are Buddhas. We have the capacity to be a Buddha. What we lack, though, is the capacity or the ability to see that. And so when we initially see this ox or see the potential of what we can be, who we are, we have this idea that, oh, I'm gonna get that. I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna take that goodness. So like the best example I can give is you go on a retreat or you do a day long or you start a beginning meditation class, any of this, and you actually begin to feel peaceful. You begin to feel still. You're like happy. You like the quiet. I can remember going to Sims when I first started. And if anybody had told me that I could go into a room and sit in silence for 2 hours and I would like it, I never would have believed that. Never. But I would go into that. I mean, I would get there early just to make sure that I was inside the room with Rodney, because it would get so crowded that you have to sit on the stairs just to listen. And I wanted to be in the room. So I would get there early just so I could get in the room, just so I could sit in quiet, sit in silence. And I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't talk. Somebody would be sitting right here and somebody sitting right here. And neither one of us talked to each other. I never would have believed that. But there was something about being in that space and appreciating this possibility of what I could be. So when we see the back of the bull last month, we want to seize that. When we see what's possible through no fault of our own, we want to seize it. We want to own it, control it, and we want to take that thing of who I'm going to be and I'm going to plant it down into my life. And I'm going to make my life better. That's what I'm going to do. And so the whole process of this month is basically the fight that we get into between what is truly Dhamma, truly ourselves, our liberated mind, and the limited mind thinking that we're in. And tonight, I thought I would talk about this a little differently to put some context around it. So it feels, so we have this sense of what is this in relation to Dhamma. So I hope I can weave this together like this. We'll see. So let's just start with the idea of delusion, of ignorance. This little tiny yogi, this little self-me Tuareg that would go to Sims and feel something, had no idea where my suffering was coming from. It had no idea that I was suffering or how the suffering would end. I had no idea how is it that I would get so still just sitting in the room with listening to Rodney, or just the room being quiet, just our meditation. How could that be that I could sit there and be still with that? And so there's a part of us that does not understand how liberation actually happens. And because of that, that's the ignorance that the Buddha was pointing to, that we don't know what dukkha is, that we don't know what the cause of dukkha is, that we don't know how the cessation of dukkha occurs, and we don't know a path that would lead to that cessation. Because we don't have that, we try to take this liberation process, or this liberation of what we see, and squish it down into what we think should be. So we were talking about this before we came back online. We were talking about this anger workshop that I offer. And something as simple as anger, we have a belief that as Buddhists, we shouldn't be angry. We should be easygoing, nice, very kind. I can't tell you how many practitioners that text me or email me and say, I need an interview. I haven't been practicing. And I'm like, really? Do you think about the Dhamma at all? Like, yes, I think about the Dhamma all the time, but I haven't been practicing. I'm not very good. And I'm thinking, there is an image that we have that in order to be a good practitioner, I need to sit on the cushion an hour a day. I was telling Thursday night or Sunday, I can't remember, that when you fill out the questionnaires for a retreat, and they asked, what's your daily practice like? The common thing is 2 hours a day. You would be stunned at how many people practice 2 hours a day. Really? 2 hours? I don't practice 2 hours a day, but they practice 2 hours a day. Really, it's probably more like 10 minutes here and there. Maybe I'll do it 30 minutes. Maybe for a week or a month, I do 30 minutes. Maybe even a year, I do 30 minutes every day. And then all of a sudden it just stops and I'm down to 5 minutes maybe. Or maybe I don't sit at all. I sit once a week when I come to Sims and that's it. But the truth is, as practitioners, we are always gradually unfolding in the Dhamma. The problem that we have in this month's picture is that we are tussling with the truth of our capacity and the limited view in which we hold it. And so the fight is us trying to take liberation and what it actually offers and stuff it into a life that's very limited, that's very confused. So here's some of the other ways that we can think about this. First, the Buddha said there are seven obsessions. Well, I want to tell you about the first obsessions. It's the five aggregates, basically. So we get obsessed with form, we get obsessed with feelings, we get obsessed with perceptions, what we think is going on, we get obsessed with our mental formations and our thoughts about what's going to happen, and we get obsessed with consciousness. We get obsessed with that as if this is all about my life, my life, my life, my life, my life, my life. And that obsession, we want to take the Dhamma, this liberated being that I can be and somehow turn me into a better person. So that's all I got to do. It's self-help Dhamma. That's what it is. So I go and I listen and I read about the Dhamma so that it will make me a better person. And then think about it. How many of you think you're not a very good practitioner because you're not a better person? You're the same person I've always been, right? I still act the same way. I still have the same habits. Everything is the same. I've been practicing for 20 years and I still do the same thing. And in that is because we think that there's something wrong and it needs to be fixed. And so a good Dhamma, a liberated being would be better than me, better than I am right now. If we really knew that it doesn't really matter how you are being, if you're interested in how you're being, interested in it. So if I get really, really angry, I get as angry today as I used to get. I haven't all of a sudden not be angry anymore. I'm still an angry person. I'll probably be angry to the day I die. And then I'll be in the next life still angry. But the difference is the whole world doesn't have to deal with my anger. Just me. My boys don't have to deal with my anger. I deal with it. I don't have to have everybody around me doing something so Tuari's not angry. But that's the way I used to be, was that if I got angry, everybody's going to be angry because somebody's going to fix it. It's like being intoxicated and you're so drunk, you can't get your mind to calm down. So you're like messing with everybody. And instead, I have learned that when I'm angry, that's for me to practice. That's for me to work out. And I just work it out. I just figure out how to be with that energy. Let it be and see what's going on. I get as interested in my anger as I do in the sound of traffic. That shift is what happens next month. In this month, we are battling that anger. We are battling the view of who we are, trying to be what we think a good yogi, good Dhamma teacher is. So we get obsessed with the feeling of unpleasantness, right? We get obsessed with, I shouldn't be feeling unpleasant. I shouldn't be overwhelmed. I was telling one of the groups that I have a student that sent me this urgent email. They had to talk to me because they just practice was completely messed up. Turns out they had eye surgery because they have cataracts and they had eye surgery. And the whatever you call the eye doctor put the wrong lens in their eye. So then when they found out they had the wrong lens, they got to have the surgery again. But it's not recommended to have that surgery twice. They say have it one time. You got to get it right the first time. So the doctor convinced them that they could have the surgery the second time and it would be okay because the doctor was not going to use a laser. He was going to do it differently. It wasn't going to be a laser. And then the doctor used a laser. So they ended up going to another doctor. And when they went to the second doctor, that's when they found out everything that happened. And she was overwhelmed with fear and panic. And so she was calling me, emailed me so we could talk on Zoom because she needed to find her practice. She couldn't find her practice. And I said, have you shot anybody? Did you kill the doctor, hit him? Have you done anything like that? She's like, no. I said, well, I think you're doing some pretty good practice. You're keeping it together. Can you imagine how scared you would be with your sight? on a relatively simple surgery that happens in our day and age. It's simple. It may not have always been simple, but it's pretty simple now, pretty standard now. And this doctor totally messed it up. And she has the possibility that she could go blind. Why wouldn't you be overwhelmed and stressed out and scared every day? But to the young yogi, to the little yogi in this picture, what that yogi wants to do is to seize the liberated mind in this concept that I will sit still with the whole thing. Everything will be okay. No problem. What, you messed up the surgery? That's okay. You didn't mean that. Maybe you were having a bad day. I'll have compassion for you. And all of that kind of way that we create this, like a magazine ad of what a good yogi is, sitting there with the sunset and beautiful, but it can't be this yogi that's cussing and screaming because they're so mad and so scared about what the eye doctor did. But the truth is that that is a yogi. That's what you are. The Dhamma is not, the Dhamma, when I say the Dhamma, the idea of a liberated being is not going to take away unpleasantness. It's not going to take away overwhelm. It helps you investigate and understand the presence of dukkha, where dukkha comes from, and how dukkha ceases. I asked her at one point, I said, she goes, well, I just think I should have handled the whole situation better. And I said, she goes, she hadn't been able to sit. And that's what she was saying, that she should have been able to sit through this. That's what she expected. She should have been able to keep her morning sit and keep her morning meditation, her practice, even though she was going through all this difficulty. So I said, well, did you know that your doctor was going to mess up the eye surgery and you were going to go through all this and you were going to miss work and all of this stuff that was going to happen? And she's like, well, no, I didn't know any of this was going to happen. I said, well, what do you think happens when something traumatic happens to the body? We don't have our minds, when we get traumatized, we don't remember things. We don't remember things. We're caught in the trauma. And we're not necessarily open to just everything going as normal. So in this picture, this yogi, this is what she would be doing. She's in this picture of five. She is trying to whip. So the picture of the this month has this little bitty yogi, and he's got a rope, a little thin rope and a whip. And he's trying to whip this massive ox into shape and control it and have it all under control. That's what she thinks she can do. She can take this liberated mind and stuff it down into her life that's now dealing with a second surgery, afraid she's going to go blind. And she's mad that her image of what she thinks a good practitioner is, isn't showing up in this month. This is what we think we own we think we have to own it. We have to control it. We have to treat it like it is the thing that's going to make us, however we have some image of what a yogi is supposed to be. This is what we're fighting with this month. It's necessary. Well, let me give you a couple more and then we'll talk about this, why I think it's necessary that we have this fight. The second, so first it's the five aggregates. there's a sense of me, of I, of my life, and we want the Dhamma, or we want the possibility of liberation, of being a liberated person, to somehow fit nicely into my life and make me a better person. And just the framing it, meaning that I have to, the form would be I have to sit 2 hours a day, you know, even though I work 90 hours a week, I gotta sit 2 hours a day. I gotta have pleasant feelings all the time. I should be in the blissful state when I'm meditating. I shouldn't be meditating and have some kind of distracted thinking constantly. I should be still and peaceful. That my perception of how I see the world should be full of love and kindness. And I certainly can't be having, you know, yelling fits in my head about Roe v. Wade. I can't be getting all scared and worried that the world is coming to an end. None of that. I got to keep it steady, keep it still, very peaceful. I'm good with whatever happens. And we have this, I should not be caught in obsessive thinking over, what if I die? What if I die? What if I'm gone blind? What if this goes wrong? What about this? What should I do about that? What if I don't? We shouldn't have that. I shouldn't obsess over some thing that I'm irritated about. These are all the five aggregates and how we have an image of what we think a liberated yogi is. And we are trying to stuff that image into our world. That's the first obsession that we do. And all of this is based out of the ignorance of not knowing what dukkha is. What is the nature of dukkha? Where does it come from? What is the nature of the cessation of dukkha? And what's the path that leads to it? So we don't really quite understand the framing of that. And so instead, we take this limited understanding and try to stuff the Dhamma into it. Then the Buddha said that it's not only the five aggregates that we obsess over, but we also obsess over seven other things. We obsess over sensual pleasure, so passion, whatever we get, you know, whatever passions we have. And we have a lot. So I have stuff that I get really, really upset about. One example would be if I come home from a retreat and my apartment is not clean, I will freak out. So I leave for the retreat. I have to clean the whole place up and then I go. And then, of course, my son lives however he lives, however he wants, whatever. But he knows that if I walk in that house and it doesn't look like it did when I left, we got a problem. I'm going to be snapping at everybody. And I'm going to try to keep it together, but I'm snapping at everybody. And I can't put my bags down and settle until I get the whole house back cleaned up again. I can't seem to come home to a dirty house. It just bothers the daylights out of me. So that is a, that would be like a sensual passion. It's some kind of, it's like the things that we just cannot tolerate and the things that we have to have it a certain way. It's the things that we really, really love. It's all of our spinning and all the stories we spin in. So when we're getting ready to go on vacation, all of that spinning, our family drama, it's all the soap operas that are going on in our lives. That's sensual passions. It's not just passions as in good. It's passions in the stuff we don't like and the stuff we do like. So we obsess over sensual passions. We obsess over resistance, things that we are resistant to, this obsessed over stuff we don't want. We don't want it to happen, and so we obsess over it. And If I don't want something to happen and it looks like it might, oh my God, I can get in a tirade trying to figure out a way to make sure it doesn't happen because I don't want it to happen. So that kind of obsessions that we have with resistance, he said we obsess over our views. Think of all the arguments we have gotten into in our lives with people about an opinion. Just take a moment. Nothing's happening. Nothing's changing. It doesn't matter what our opinions are, but we have spent countless hours arguing with another being because we have a difference of opinion. And that is an obsession. It is important that people have the same opinions, or we don't like people with different opinions, and just their opinion. They don't have to act on that opinion at all. They can just hate Black people. They don't even act on it. They don't ever talk to nobody bad. They're not mean. They just hate Black people. If I hear that they hate Black people, oh my God, the arguments that will ensue because they have an opinion, not because they act on it and cause harm, but just the opinion alone. We don't like it. We get obsessed with it, and we get obsessed with what opinions people have. So it's not just views, resistance, passions, it's uncertainty. He said, we obsess over anything that we can't completely know exactly how it's going to be. So we worry, 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 worry all the time. And we live in a world where there's always uncertainty. So we're always obsessing over it. Conceit. So we obsess over, am I better than them? Am I equal to them? Am I less than them? There's a Zen thing that you can do. I don't have it here. I should have thought about it. But I've seen a couple of teachers do this. So they bring a leaf in, and they say this is a pretty large leaf, and they compare it to maybe the leaf with like a little paperclip. It's like, oh, this is a large leaf. And you'll say, yes, that's a large leaf. And then they put up another leaf that is small, that is larger than this leaf. But all of a sudden that leaf looks smaller. And they'll say, oh, this is the large leaf. This one's the large one. This one's smaller. Okay, this is the large leaf. And then they'll pull up another leaf. So you can see that we have a comparing mind. We always compare which is larger, which is better, which is good, which is bad. And that obsession around comparing everything, making sure we live up to everything, that is another obsession that we have. Has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the nature of the mind we live with. So there's two more. Becoming. What's going to happen in the future? Am I going to become this? Am I going to become that? And is this going to happen? You know, it's the worry is obsessing over uncertainty is the fear of something negative happening. The obsessing over becoming is this wanting something good to happen, wanting something to happen a certain way. And we obsess over that. And we obsess over ignorance. So our delusions, not really ever paying attention to what's actually happening. It's more like wrong view. We're not watching our obsessions. Instead, we are just living out of our obsessions. All right. So you take the five aggregates. You take these obsessive behaviors that we have. And you have it all shielded in this kind of ignorance that doesn't understand the Four Noble Truths. And that is the ego that's trying to take a free and liberated mind and apply it to my life. That's why there is this massive struggle during this month. This is why we struggle with the Dhamma period. This is why the Dhamma takes a lifetime or two or several hundred, depending on what your view is. That's why it takes so long, because we are the liberated mind itself is completely free. But the beings that we are trapped in an egoic mind, a conditioned mind. And that conditioned mind is trying to understand, frame, and embody a liberated mind, or the possibility of liberation. We don't really know how to do that. We get still, and we have moments where we feel like I don't even get reactive. Something just happens. I mean, we have these great moments in practice. And that moment is like seeing the ox. And then we want to grab a hold of it and try to figure out how can I make that happen all the time. But the being that's trying to make this happen all the time is the being that's stuck in these obsessions. It's the being that's stuck in a conceptualized world. I think that was the only one. Oh, maybe I'll save that one for the later, for the next time we get together. So here we have this moment in time is so important as practitioners, because the only way to see and understand the possibility of true liberation is struggling with your anger. See, if you just tried, if there was a way that we could just, I want to tell you another story with a yogi who was, who did the 2 months. So he was a student, one of the students of mine in the February month long, and then he stayed on in the March month long. And sometimes you have what I call dukkha retreats on long retreats, and this was his dukkha retreat. So he got trapped in a lot of fear that kept coming up in his meditations and sit. And really the fear that was coming up was the fear he had when he was a little kid. And by the end of that February month long, he had come to befriend this little kid that was so afraid for most of his life. And so he was really easy and still and patient with this fear. But when you get still and patient with fear, what you begin to see is the stuff behind the fear, that the fear was really like anger. It's what's protecting you from the stuff behind it. So right when I was leaving, he was coming into a lot of sadness, which is, where the reason why he was so afraid, he was really afraid that he was going to be sad, afraid of disappointment, afraid of that. And so my heart was just so like sending him metta, that he just like steady with this. Don't worry about it. Don't think that something's wrong because you're going from fear to sadness. Just steady yourself with this. And so he sent me an email, and we had a practice meeting. And what he was sharing with me was that he found refuge in sadness. But what he realized was that if he just allowed himself to be sad, there was actually a lot of kindness with it, compassion with it. He said he could even feel joy or happy because he was sad and he was okay that he was sad and I didn't have to do anything about it. And he had this equanimity. So he had all the Brahma Viharas showing up with his practicing with sadness and he was okay with it. But he said that he got so mad at his teacher because his teacher said something about joy is too high a bar for you. His teacher said, I don't think you should strive for joy. You should just stay with the sadness itself. Joy is too high a bar for you. So, of course, when he heard that, you know, he thought, clearly this teacher meant that I'm not good enough for joy. I'm like, do you really think the teacher meant that that way? He's like, well, what other way could he mean it? He could have meant that striving for joy, you would never see it. But if you just stayed with the sadness, you would see joy. Isn't that what happened to you? And he goes, yeah, that's what happened to me. I said, well, if the teacher had told you, just stay with sadness and you'll see joy, you're not going to believe that. Your mind would be convinced that that's not possible. But if he tells you don't strive for joy, now you're going to open and look for joy everywhere because you're going to prove him wrong. You're going to believe, no, there's joy here. I know it. I'm going to find it. This, what he and I talked about was the truth that his willingness to stay with the sadness and not even get caught up in grumbling about the teacher, instead just saying the teacher didn't know what he was talking about, I'm gonna do my practice myself. And I was like, really? And what happened? He found all this joy in the sadness. What this picture is pointing to, next month, we're going to be in that place where he ended up being at the end of March, which was joy is a part of sadness. Kindness is a part of sadness. Compassion, equanimity, they are all contained in sadness. You don't have to get rid of the sadness in order to experience joy. You have to be willing to be fully with the sadness. And in the next month, the fifth picture, the yogi is finally willing to be with life as it is. But in this month, we are fighting our concept of what we think it should be like and what it actually is. That fight is a necessary fight to begin to see how to actually open to liberation. What that means is our overwhelm, and when we find ourselves fighting with the being overwhelmed, that fighting, if we can find a way to say, oh, I'm in a fight, that fight, I got to see here, what is it that I'm obsessing over, that I'm trying to make the Dhamma fit my obsession rather than seeing the fight itself. I hope this makes sense. It's sort of like being in this picture here. We are living out of the concept rather than experiencing the moment. So remember when I was guiding in the meditation and I was saying, sometimes you notice that you're thinking. And when you notice that you're thinking, you're actually not thinking. You're actually aware that thinking is going on. But when you are thinking, you don't know you're thinking. So you're thinking and you're lost in the concept itself. And this picture is the struggle between our concept of what we think a liberated mind or how a good yogi should be or how our practice should be rather than actually just letting whatever the moment is unfold in its own way. We are struggling between that thoughts about what practice should look like and the truth of what practice actually is to us. We need to be in these struggles, though. We need to see the mind obsessing over the five aggregates. We need to see the mind obsessing over our, we need to know we're obsessing over an opinion. We need to know we're obsessing over wanting things a certain way or not wanting things a certain way. Or we need to see ourselves worrying. It doesn't mean we're a bad yogi. It just means we're worrying. That's it. It's the mind obsessing over uncertainty. And if we begin to see it, then we can begin to allow ourselves to find the level of peace within whatever is happening. I guess the last stuff I want to say here, and then we'll take some questions and see where some of the lines are. I just don't know if I can, I'll see if I can say this. You really don't have to be a different person. You really don't have to somehow or another figure out how to be a better person. There is no better person than who you are right now. What this month is trying to help us see is that the problem is not, the challenge is not who we are. It's the inability to see, I guess, who's actually controlling the moment. That's the better way to think about it. So it's like, even though we're adults now, we're all big people, grown people, we still have our little five-year-old. Everybody's got their five-year-old, right? You still got it. You can sometimes feel that little five-year-old talking. You can feel that five-year-old having the tantrum. You can feel it, and you feel 5 years old. You don't want the five-year-old driving the car to go to work. You want the you want to be an adult driving the car and going to work. And so what the Dhamma is trying, what this ox can help us see is the limitations that we are applying in any given moment. We can use the ox to actually see the limited conditioning of the mind that's trying to fix this problem. That wise mind can help us see it. But we have to trust, we have to learn that that wise being actually exists at the same time. This is, it is a, it is a strange phenomena that we are practicing with, and you can't see it better than in this month. But we are actually using a mind that we don't even understand how it exists, to free us from a mind that thinks it understands everything and is messing up everything. So we're, we are in a practice that the very aspect that is liberating, we don't understand how to access it. And yet it's still liberating us little bit by little bit by little bit. And it's only taking a long time because we live in an egoic mind that won't listen to anything, won't listen, thinks it knows what it's doing, trying to beat the whole process into submission. And that's why it takes a long time. It doesn't take a long time because we don't have a liberated mind. The mind is already liberated. At least, I guess, Mahayana belief that the mind is already limited, liberated. Theravadins don't really think of it so much like that. But for the purposes of our lay practitioners, we don't worry about it like that. Mind already liberated. That liberated mind actually helps us see that. And the way it helps us see that is it tells us now when we're overwhelmed, right? We're overwhelmed, but we know we're overwhelmed. And there's something about knowing it that we can now practice with it. We're worrying all the time. And then all of a sudden we'll wake up and we'll notice that I'm worrying, 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 obsessing over that. It's like, oh, I notice what I'm doing. We know now when we are in that egoic, limited, conditioned mind. Not so easy to get out of it, but it starts with recognizing when we're in it. And then gradually, over time, we actually bring the two minds together. And we actually began to move through the world through our liberated mind more than we do the egoic mind. Let's stop there. We'll just take a moment. Think about all this I've said. And just sit here. Let the silence kind of stop everything, and then we'll see what questions have come up. Let's think a moment. What does all this mean to you? Wherever you are in your practice, you're definitely part of this picture here. You're part of the catching the ox. You've all seen it. So what does it mean? All righty. Thank you so much for your kind attention. So let's see if anybody has any comments or questions or, you know, just want to share. It's fine. Yeah, go ahead, Judith. Can you unmute yourself?
Okay, so I totally relate to everything you said. And I have noticed that more and more and more I do see myself freaking out or whatever the thing is. And it was very helpful to say, you know, to say that it's like, okay, right? And I, because I do have this feeling, all this meditation and I'm still, you know.
That's right.
But I have noticed that when I see it happening, it doesn't last as long. It really doesn't.
Yeah. So, and you're not the one freaking out. It's not Judith freaking out. It's right. A mind that does not like anything uncertain and doesn't like anything it doesn't like. It's that right. limited little yogi. Yeah. That person is the one that's freaking out. It's conditioned right. to expect the world to be perfect and beautiful and lovely.
Right.
And yeah. so, yeah. But that, the wisdom you can see is in the recognition that you're freaking out. Oh, I see. I see what's happening. I see what I'm doing here. Settle down a little bit.
Right. And also the feeling like I don't have to act on it.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
No, it's you not, don't. And there's nothing wrong. What I'm trying to point to is there's nothing wrong with the fact that you're freaking out.
Right.
You don't want to act on it because it just causes harm in other beings. And you're not really practicing with it if you just react to your freak out.
Right.
But
yeah.
Even but if it, you react, you want to see that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is very helpful to understand that I don't have to be all the time peaceful, and that what's important is to see what's happening. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right.
So thanks.
That's right. That's great. And this month is about that. Is about the struggle that we have with this unrealistic view of how we should be as practitioners. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Amy. You know, one of the things since I've been doing this work for, I don't know, at least 10 years now, and I think I definitely have that self-awareness in, you know, I can really feel where I am, which is very, very helpful to my life. And I'm very much happier because of it. But I also know because I'm so self-aware of how I feel that I find my world kind of gets a little smaller and smaller and smaller. Cause I notice like, oh, that thing triggers me and that thing, like I can just feel like all the kind of bad juju in the world in some ways. And so I kind of struggle with having an expansive life. And also having that self-awareness, because I think when I'm really like, really aware of how I feel, that means a lot of the time, what I'd rather just do is be home by myself.
Yeah.
You know? And so I have to like push myself to go out in the world more than I used to back before when I was so unconscious and just living, you know? So, and that's not really a question as much as really an observation that I find myself kind of, that's like what I struggle against now more than the unconscious behavior, but I just struggle against wanting to isolate because that's the safest place to be, you know?
Yes, I see. But Amy, I guess another thing you could begin to see is why do you want to be in the house? Because being in the house, because you think it's like, I thought you said it's the safest place to be, right? That's more like an obsession over resistance. That's more of, I don't want to be around that. And so I'm going to stay over here because I won't be myself if I'm over here. If I go, it's almost like if I go out in the world, I guess I should say it like this. If I come home and the house is a mess, I won't be able to keep my cool.
Well, my house, I live by myself.
So no. What I'm saying is I won't be able to keep my cool. So I need my son to make sure the house is clean when I come in the house because I won't lose my cool, right? The point of this picture is to know that that's what I'm doing in order to keep myself from losing my cool. But if I walk in the house early or unexpected and the house is a mess, that is the place where practice actually happens. Right. It doesn't happen if he cleans the house up before I get home. What real practice is connected to is knowing that that is a obsession of mine. And if I walk into the house and the house is not clean, can I be okay with the fact that I'm freaking out?
Yeah.
That's what we're really trying to practice with, is learn to be with the experience of freaking out. Because the reason why I'm pointing to this is that if we live our lives only by framing everything so that I don't freak out, then yes, we do. It does look better for us. It looks, you know, we look good.
You're more peaceful.
We're very peaceful. Everything's going good. Nothing's going wrong. But we also never practice with overwhelm. So then when overwhelm comes, we are, we're almost falling apart. It's too much. So we are the going out and you don't have to go out. You know, you can, it's not a have to, but it's the recognition that if I'm staying in because it feels safer, then there's some kind of a conditioning I'm putting around being in practice. That's what it is that you're doing. Yeah. So the going out is really just to begin to see, how do I practice with being in a world that's so angry right now? Mm. And most of this is, if I go out, it's going to trigger my anger too. And we don't want to be angry. So we stay in so we don't get angry. But we really are angry with the way things are. Mm. Do you see?
Yeah.
We got to just practice with the anger. So this picture is more about beginning to see how much we are beating or whipping our possible freedom into shape.
Yeah.
That's what we want to see. I'll see if there's any, do you have anything else? I was going to see if there's,
thank you.
I was going to see if there was another, if I could find Pema Chodron's quote, but I can't, I don't know if I'll be able to find it. She made a quote about how the ego is like it's like having our own room. And so we just want a little peace. And so we're just in our little room. But that what the ego does is, this is why it's limiting, because it keeps convincing us that, oh, it should be like this. We just have our room just the way we want it. And it's peaceful. And this is the kind of life I want. And this is good. And we get stuck in a smaller and smaller, like you're saying, smaller and smaller world.
All the people I'm around are healthy people. If I want to only have healthy people around me and all that. Right. It means your world gets really small.
That's right. But the truth is, that's what I mean by, we actually have these massive liberated minds, the capacity for massive liberated minds, which means in reality, we can walk out into the world just that the way the world is, full of joy, full of happiness, full of freedom and peace. But the ego doesn't believe we can do that.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Hmm. Oh, you did? Oh, great. See, some people can find that stuff. Yeah, so come over here and read it.
Ego is like a room of your own, a room with a view, with the temperature and the smells and the music that you like. You want it your own way. You just like to have a little peace. You just like to have a little happiness. You know, just give me a break. But the more you think that way, the more you try to get life to come out so that it will always suit you, the more your fear of other people and what's outside your room grows, rather than becoming more relaxed, you start pulling down the shades and locking the door. When you do go out, you find the experience more and more unsettling and disagreeable. You become touchier, more fearful, more irritable than ever. The more you try to get it your way, the less you feel at home.
Yep. That's it. That's the quote. Doesn't that make sense?
Oh, yeah. It's gorgeous.
That is the little yogi's view of the world. And you see how it's making it smaller, smaller, smaller. But really, the ox in these pictures is our true self. That's what the ox is. The true capacity of who we are. And the Dhamma is, I call it the Dhamma because it's the Dhamma that's pointing to that true capacity. So the ego is making our lives smaller, tinier, tinier, tinier. And yet we are actually trying to control this massive capacity we have. If we knew who we were, I mean, who we were as human beings, yeah, we wouldn't have to worry about things like war, hunger. We wouldn't have to worry about Roe v. Wade. We wouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff. But the only reason why we have to worry about it is because our egoic sense is so conditioned that it creates little bitty tiny beings. And then we're afraid of everything. But the actual ox of who we are is tremendous. And so this is about learning how to see how small and limited that we're making our life. And the possibility of actually beginning to see the truth of who we are and what's possible. I believe that that's going to happen, though. I believe that I had a priest one time gave a homily one year. It was the best homily, best sermon I've ever heard in my entire life. And I was a Christian for many, 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 many years. The best sermon I ever heard. He was given a sermon on Catholicism, they have certain sermons for certain times. And this was the sermon around the hell, brimstone, fire, you know, the world's going to come to an end. Pentecost. That must have been what it is. Yes. And he's giving this sermon. And he said, he goes, okay, I'm going to tell you how I see the end of the world coming. And he said that he was an alcoholic for many, many years. And he came to understand that nobody was coming to save him, that nobody was going to come and figure out a way to get his life together. That really, when he finally had enough of getting drunk, he would be free. And so that's what he did. He just completely got himself sober, and he got clean and sober. So he said that what he believed was going to be this Pentecost, the end of the world, was one by one, we were all going to say, I've had enough. Nobody's coming to save me. I'm going to save myself one at a time. Each one, and then one, and then one, and it was going to grow. And he said at some point, he believed there was just going to be a massive awakening when we all finally said, that's it, I've had enough, no more. And that, when the mind turns with that understanding, then, yeah, the idea of being afraid of war just wouldn't happen. I know it seems like that. It's not possible, you know, because there's all kinds of bombs and things, and it feels like that's not possible. But I do believe that at some point, the more beings that awaken and touch into this awakened self, the less we're going to worry about some of these wars and rumors of wars, world hunger. I think the less we'll worry about how destructive we'll be to the climate. I just don't know if we'll be able to do all that before the climate, the earth kind of drop kicks us off because they've had enough. I don't know if we can do it before we've completely, you know, ruined our ability to live on this planet. I don't know. But I do know that if we began to connect to this awakened mind, then I think we can, we'll be a completely, we'll move through the world in a completely different way. Anyway, that seems like that's a good place to end. All right. Great. Well, good people, I hope I didn't go too far over the top. You know, I can kind of go out there thinking about how free we can get, but I can't help it. It's because I believe it in my heart and soul. I've seen it. And I know what my mind was. I know the trauma I came out of. And so I know what's possible. It's just the willingness and the patience to wait for it. All right. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for coming online. We'll see you all next week for VSAC.